Okay, let's see how far we get today. I start with these great plans, and I don't always get there. Anyway, I want to start again with the Buddha, start with the guide. I find that the more I explore the Buddha, the more clearer spiritual life becomes if you look at the Buddha's life. And of course, I'm looking at the Buddha's life and I'm trying to reimagine that life for us, if you know what I mean. Surely that's the only value of looking at it, not for historical reasons particularly, but for spiritual truths which must be universal. And those truths, I think, more and more personally, are embedded in the story, in the metaphors, in the legend, and that if we can sort of explore the story, the metaphor and the legend, we'll understand spiritual life more deeply, I think. I even had a little bit of a theory that I wonder whether they were the parts of the Buddha's life that were most remembered. Like, I've just been upstairs just earlier on writing about Pratitya Samuppada, you know, that was the Buddha's great discovery under the Bodhi tree when he gained enlightenment was, well, to put it conceptually, was the discovery of Pratitya Samuppada, conditioned co-production. But I wonder how many people remembered that. I mean, it's rather difficult to remember, and you can probably remember the tag, this being that arises. But to get much from that, you have to explore it very, very deeply. But you would remember all the stories. You would remember the metaphors that the Buddha used. He might have said, it was as if a great army approached me and tried to pull me off my seat. You would remember that. Do you see what I mean? I think people remember stories, don't they, very well. I can remember many of the stories from the Buddha's life. I can't remember even sometimes the Eightfold Path. You know, I can't remember lists very easily, but I do remember stories very, very easily without even having to be told them more than once. A compelling story, then compelling simile even, you'll remember. Anyway, that's my little theory, that therefore they might actually be closer to the truth because they've been remembered. So we have to then imagine that Siddhartha's seen the foresight. Remember, it's the foresight that is, in a way, the arising of Buddhism in the world. He sees the foresight, and we have to imagine him going back home and being in a kind of agony of questioning. According to tradition, he's living in the palace with his wife and his young son, Rahula. People sometimes get a bit hung up on this, but nobody actually knows whether that's true. In the earliest bits of the Pali Canon where the Buddha talks about his experience, which are usually very, very short, he doesn't say anything about a wife and son. And in the earliest carvings you get of the going forth, which are earlier than the written down scriptures, there's no wife and son in the carvings either. So it's quite likely to be a later embellishment, all of that. Although I think, again, like all embellishments in mythic stories, it's a real spiritual truth, but it may not be literally the case that the Siddhartha had a son. One of the things I think it does, as a story, that aspect of the story does say and does communicate, is that the Buddha had sex. Sorry to throw this in. Everyone's terribly shocked. Oh, you're very sensitive. But that's how you get children. I don't know whether people are aware of that. I won't talk you through the biology, but that is, you know, generally speaking, how you do it. And what that does, it reminds us that the Buddha was just an ordinary human being. Well, perhaps not an ordinary human being, but the Buddha was just like you or I. He was a young man who'd known sex, who'd known pleasure, who'd a very privileged young man, really. In the West, we're almost in an identical situation. Probably all of us have known sex. Possibly not as much as we'd like to have known it. That was a joke. And just in case. and we're all very, very privileged. in comparison with most of the world, most of the time, we're in, you know, the top 5% of privileged people. We're unthinkably privileged, really. We all of us, I think particularly in Sweden, actually, live like Renaissance princes. We experience a level of comfort that would have been unthinkable even by aristocracy at one age. I mean, just think of the heating of houses, for instance. Even if you were an aristocrat, you would be cold. So we're like him. We've experienced the pleasure palace. Like him, we're very privileged. Not unlike him, we haven't really seen the nature of things. We haven't really seen the four sides. And unless we become integrated and emotionally positive, we won't see them. We can be at Buddhist seminars about them, we can give Buddhist seminars about them, but unless we become integrated, we won't see them. It'll just be an idea. And spiritual life is not an idea, primarily. It uses ideas, but it's not an idea. Spiritual life is something you do, it's our life. It's not an idea about your life. So, Siddhartha comes back to the palace in this sort of agony of questioning. And then, one night he thinks, I'm going to have to go. I'm just going to have to leave. And there's no way for it, I'm just going to have to leave. And perhaps he talked to people before he did that. Perhaps he said to people, look, do you not see that life ends in death? We can't just continue as if nothing's happened. Do you not see that? And probably some people said, oh, well, you'll live on in your son. Oh, yes, it does, but you'll live on in your son. A sort of materialist answer. Or people would say, yes, I know, but you can't do anything about it. So, you know, the main thing is to do is just to have pleasure. There isn't a solution to it. So, there you go, you know, just accept it and have pleasure. Or people would have rationalised it away in one way or another. So perhaps you did ask those questions, you never know. And then one night you just thought, nobody around me knows. Not only did nobody around me know, but nobody around me wants to know about the reality, really. People are willfully ignorant. Ignorance in Buddhism isn't to do with lack of intellectual skill. In fact, I've known very intellectual people who are ignorant. It means an ignorance about how things are, a willingness, even a will to turning away from things, an unwillingness to look at truth. And the problem with intellect, it so easily can cloud that with looking like with intellectual brilliance, but really it's still an unwillingness to look at the truth. Of course, it's not always that, but it can be. So he left in the middle of the night, and according to the tradition, the night he went back and saw his sleeping wife and his son sleep, and must have felt heartbroken in leaving them. Whether that's actually true or not, I don't know, but that's what it says in the story. And then he asked his charioteer to saddle him his horse, Kantaka, beautiful white stallion. And he got onto the horse, Chandaka followed. Interesting again, remember the name Chandaka means he was interested. So he asked his interest to take him out of this world. He asked his interest to take him beyond the small world of family relationships, status, career, being someone. In a way, that's another way of imagining the palace. It's all to do with being someone. Being a this sort of person, not a that sort of person. Being a wife or a mother or a child. Being a prince or a pauper. Being having a certain social standing. I think it goes very deep in us human beings. We want to be someone. We want to be important. And we create around ourselves a palace of importance to show how important we are. Try and make a splash. We can't help it, really. We think of ourselves as the centre of life, don't we? We think that of everybody in the whole universe, the person whose day has been most important has been mine. You couldn't be more embattled, in a way. We've created a palace that's also a battlement, a prison even. And it's all to do with being infatuated with ourselves, as being at the very centre of things, as if the world really is patterned around us. So the Buddha, Siddhartha, rather leaves all that behind. He leaves all kind of social standing, all prestige, all sense of being someone, all possibility of worldly gain. In the story, he was supposed to be, or he was obviously going to inherit his father's land, his father's palace. So he leaves all that behind. He leaves behind his social relationships. He leaves behind his family. And he leaves them behind in the middle of the night, which is an archetypal time, isn't it, in the middle of the night. This is what happens in fairy stories. Things happen at midnight. So he leaves at midnight, and when he leaves, devas, who according to tradition are like, they're sort of like Buddhist version of angels, except for they're not quite so pious. They're not so sort of sweet looking. They appear, and they make everything silent so that everybody falls asleep. It's a lovely, I really like this image. You have to imagine above the palace starlit night at midnight, you have to imagine the charioteer bringing out this white horse, which again is very symbolic. Something to do with our relationship with nature, isn't it? The power of nature, the energy of nature. The beauty of nature, either, and brings this horse out, and everybody falls asleep. The guards, the king has posted guards at the gate to stop Siddhartha leaving, and they've all fallen asleep. The king himself has fallen asleep. And as Siddhartha rides through the palace courtyards, the devas put their hands out so that the hooves of the horse drop onto the deva's hands and don't make a sound. Yeah. And then when Siddhartha gets to the gates of the palace, the gates of the palace miraculously open. Yeah. And Siddhartha leaves the palace on this white horse. You can imagine it shimmering off into the night till it's just disappeared, followed by Chandaka. And again, it's very striking. It struck me when I wrote about this, never thought of it before, that as far as I know, and certainly in my readings of the story, this is the first time the devas arrive. This is the first time that magical events happen. I mean, in some later traditions of the telling of the story, there's magical events throughout, but it's very interesting that this is where the magical events happen. This is when the devas arrive. This is when doors open by magic. This is where people are put to sleep. This is when magic happens. And there must be a significance in that. Why magic happening now? There was no devas around the three sites. There was no devas mentioned around the fourth site. But this is when the devas appear. Now, when you look at the Buddha's biography, supernatural events like this, which I think have central significance to our understanding of spiritual truth, supernatural events happen at the key points in the story. They happen at key points in the story. Most of them happen, for instance, at the Enlightenment. Many happen at the Parinirvana. But here they start now. So the devas appear now. So this leaving the palace, this is saying, this is a central moment in spiritual life. This leaving, this going forth, as it's called, is a central moment in spiritual life. But there's no spiritual life without this going forth. We cannot stay at home. We might literally be able to stay at home in our actual homes, but we cannot stay in our normal, everyday mindset. At the very least, it means that. I think it actually means something more than that. It means that we cannot just collect around ourselves more and more of the world and hope to go beyond the world. One of the great dangers in life is that we get better and better at getting our way. We get better and better at having things that we like, getting our pleasures, getting our partner put up with our grumbling in the morning and all that sort of thing. We kind of make a world around us that sort of fits ourself and supports it and enhances it, fixes it, so that very often the people who are closest to us have got the strongest views about who we are and fix us and we fix them. And we create a world around us that is the kind of outer shell of ourself. It's like the carapace of selfhood. We're attached to our fridge freezer and our cappuccino frother and our Armani jeans and all that sort of thing. They've all become parts of me, my selfhood. And it's very easy to gradually amass those things, even when we're supposed to be trying to see through that. So Siddhartha leaves all that behind. I think it's because he actually acts that the devas arise. I think the significance of the devas is because he does something. Sangharakshita famously said that an ounce of practice is worth a ton of theory, which is something I think is a brilliant little aphorism. An ounce of practice is worth a ton of theory. So the Buddha, Siddhartha, actually does something. In a way, you only know if you mean something if you do something. If you don't do something, you don't mean it. So if I say I've fallen in love with you and I don't make a date with you, I obviously don't mean it. You know what I mean? If I say I love you, but actually I'm really busy at the moment, I won't be able to see you till next Wednesday, you sort of think, doesn't sound like love to me. You know what I mean? If I say I love opera and I don't go to opera, I don't love opera. It's just a word. You know what I mean? So the way that we know whether we've seen something, genuinely seen something, rather than merely cognize something, is whether we act. And that acting has an internal dimension and an external dimension. And I'll try and talk a bit about those things today.
When you're saying acting, because sometimes we talk about, well, it's not the action, it's the intention.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So the sort of relationship between these two.
Yes, that's right. So I'll try and weave that in. Of course, the Buddhist conception of acting is actions of body, speech and mind. If we don't remember Buddhism, we'll end up with a sort of, probably a Christian conception of action, which is doing things, but doesn't include very often speaking and thinking. But your mind, what you think, is an action. Everything really is an action. But I think that the devas appear here because he changes his life. He acts wholly on the basis of a whole seeing. So not only does he see the four sights in a whole way, he acts completely on that basis. He doesn't sort of shilly-shally, he doesn't philosophize about the sights, he doesn't think about it, he does something. And this is right at the heart of Buddhism. Bhante once famously said that Christians say, "El credo, I believe." Philosopher would say, "El cogito, I think." But the Buddhists say, "Gacchami," which means "I go." In other words, I go for refuge. So Buddhism is primarily something you do. It's not primarily something you believe or you think. So the Buddha goes forth. He leaves it all behind. And I think that's why the devas appear. And I see this going forth as the initiating the great stage, second great stage of spiritual life, positive emotion. That's really what it's saying. On the basis of integrated seeing, on the basis of seeing our real human predicament, not glossing over it, not intellectualizing, not thinking it's okay, but really seeing our human predicament, the Buddha acts completely on that basis. He goes off to search for the truth. in his case, in the most utterly uncompromising way imaginable. We might not be able to do that. We won't be able to follow him literally into the forest. But we will need to find some way of following him. And that will need to mean an internal change, even a radical internal change. And it will mean some external change. If it doesn't mean some external change, it becomes notional, becomes something we think about. And Buddhism is not a path of something we think about. Anyway, what was I going to say? Yes, so the first thing I wanted to then emphasise is this second stage of positive emotion. It's to do with acting. It's to do with what you do. Actually, these words, positive emotion, aren't very good. Positive could sound like it means just being up. People even say you have a positive attitude, don't they? But it really means something very weak indeed. It could just mean that positive just means up, you know. Or it could just mean something very weak, so it doesn't mean that. And emotion is is a bit wrong, really. But it suggests it's all to do with what you feel. Actually, it's all to do with what you do, because it's what you do that shows you what you really feel. You see what I mean? I can be as effusive about opera as I like, but if I don't go to opera, I clearly don't really feel those things. You know? Your action confirms how you think about something. It confirms how you feel about something. I mean, I think the romantic analogy is very striking, isn't it? If you feel like you've fallen in love with somebody, if you fancy someone, you'll definitely want to act on it. You won't want to just think about it. You'll want to do something in every sense, yeah? So this makes it clear that a distinction between emotion and sentimental emotion. So sentimental emotion is emotion that we like to have because people will admire us for it. And it's a great danger in spiritual life. For some reason, spiritual life has been rather associated with emotion, at least it is at the moment. Probably in the early days in the West, it was very much associated with intellect, but now it's become associated more with emotion. But sentimental emotion, as I say, is emotion that you like to have because you will be admired for it. So that's why you can have sentimental pity, you can have sentimental love, you can have things like sentimental indignation, but you can never have sentimental resentment or sentimental depression, because nobody will admire you for those things. There's no such thing as sentimental spite, for instance, but there is such a thing as sentimental love. Because you want to be seen as someone that's very large-hearted. There is such a thing as sentimental pity, because you want to be seen as being very compassionate. There is such a thing as sentimental indignation, because you want to be seen as somebody who's really concerned with the problems of the world. But sentimental emotion doesn't lead to action. That's how you know whether it's sentimental or not. The philosopher who's talked about that, they said that the sentimentalist will always betray you because their emotions aren't really to do with you. So they might seem to be really concerned about you, but when you actually ask for help, they'll strangely not be there. Because it's really more that they want to feel that they're the sort of person who's concerned about people rather than an actual person who actually is concerned about people. And so on. People can talk about the environment and get very indignant about the environment, but very often it just boils down to a different kind of washing powder. We still end up with a flat of our own, with a washing machine of our own, with the whole kit and caboodle of modern Western life, but we use Ecover washing up liquid, if you have that in 3 litre or the 3 litre equivalent. If we're not careful, it's another thing of being a sentimental emotion. So it's actually quite difficult to avoid sentimental emotion altogether. But sentimental emotion won't get us anywhere and actually will end up betraying people. There's a lovely bit in the film called Lincoln, this recent film called... Is it Lincoln? No. The Spielberg film, yeah. There's a lovely character in it who's very, very outspoken. I can't remember what his name is. He's not Lincoln himself, his other politician. He's very, very outspoken, too outspoken, and nobody will go with what he says. And there's a lovely discussion at one point where Lincoln is talking, and this other guy is saying, hang on, it's not that I like the people, I just want to help them. I just think the situation they're in is not right. And I thought that was very good in a way. It can be like that. It's not necessarily that you particularly like people, but yes, you think that the good should be done, that the right should be done. It doesn't necessarily imply that you feel for them in an emotional way. In this character, he just very strong. In this case, it was to do with a race. And he just very strongly felt, no, black people should be treated exactly the same as white people. I'm not saying I particularly like either black people or white people, but that should be the case. You know, that was much more like, I thought, much more like compassion, if you mean. It was just objectively thinking, no, that should not happen. It's not to do with whether I like it or not, those people or not. It's to do with the fact that it just shouldn't be like that. Yeah. So that's important to clarify what emotion is. In Buddhism, you confirm what you feel by how you act. So, Subhuti and probably Bhante would like to think of this stage as well as the stage of kusala karma. Kusala means skilled or skillful. I quite like to think of it as just skilled, and karma just means action. So it's the stage of skilled action. So on the basis of self-knowledge, on the basis of knowing the kind of creature you are, whether you're an extrovert or an introvert, how you flourish in the world, what conditions you need to get into the best state of mind, you act for the well-being of all. You act in a skilled way. You act in your own best interest, in a way. I really like this metaphor of skilled. It's not to do with whether you act in a good or a bad way. You just act in the most skilled way that will create the best results for you and for everyone. Really, the great principle here is the principle of doing the least possible harm and the most possible good. With the emphasis on the latter part of that aphorism, on the most possible good. Actually, it's impossible to do no harm. Even the very fact that we live here, work on computers, turn on lights, is causing incredible harm in the world. We can't live without harm. So for us, particularly, our task is how do we do the most good? So the whole second stage of spiritual life, of our human life really, of our growing up, because remember there's no such thing as a spiritual life separate of that. The second great stage of our growing up is how do we do the least harm and the most good? How do we make the greatest contribution to our own life and to the lives of those around us? The German poet Goethe said, you should go to bed every night and say to yourself, what have I done to glorify my life tonight? Very nice way of putting it. What have I done to glorify my life today? I'd want to just say, what have I done to glorify life today? What have I done to glorify other people's lives? What have I done to make it wonderful? What have I contributed? Yeah. That's a much more important question ethically than what naughty things have I done and how many Chelsea cinnamon buns of heat. that's my excuse. The real question is, what have I contributed? What have I given? Yeah. What have I done to glorify my life? And sometimes that can be, I've done nothing at all, and that's been a great glory. Sometimes, it's so beautiful at the moment, isn't it? And I do think Sweden is so beautiful. You know, all you need to do is sit and look at one of these barns. But there you go, it's just glory. You know what I mean? Glorifying your life doesn't necessarily mean literally doing something. But it does mean not frittering our time away in the pub in useless chit-chat, letting our life bleed away on the internet. It does mean not getting into silly arguments. It does mean not taking offence. It does mean giving and contributing. Really, that's what this stage comes down to, is doing the most possible good for myself and for all beings. Sangharakshita wants to put it like this. He wants to say, we should move from how can I be happy to how can we be happy. So in every situation you're in, all you need to do is say, how can we be happy? Not just me, but if you're at home with your partner and your children, how can we be happy? If you're at work, how can we be happy? If you're on retreat, how can we be happy? But I think we need to be extending that all the time. So how can we in Sweden be happy? How can we in Europe be happy? How can we in the whole world be happy? Because the broader you make that we, the more challenging it is to I. You see what I mean? You see what I mean? It really does challenge us. W.H. Auden, the English poet, he talked about our love of 10 people. It's a brilliant little summation in a poem that just mentions our love of 10 people. And that's about it, isn't it? Usually that's what we end up with, is our love of 10 people. Usually one of them is a dog. our love of 9 people and a dog. Or actually 8 people, a dog and a cat. Or 7 people, a dog, a cat and a butcher. It's your parents, your children, your partner, your brother or your sister, perhaps a friend, if you're lucky. Ends up being 10 people. I love it. And this stage of Kusala Karma, or positive emotion, is moving beyond our love of 10 people. So I only want to talk about 3 things about this, because I want to start to then go on to spiritual death. And I want to talk about them very practically, because this second great stage is to do with action. It's based on... And remember, action needs to be based on self-knowledge. Otherwise, as Nietzsche said, the German philosopher, your love of others is your bad love of yourself. In other words, your apparent love of other people is really to do with your own discomfort in yourself. You have to fuss about the welfare of others because you can't bear to face your own suffering. I have met people who do fuss about the welfare of others for egoistic reasons. It's actually rather irritating. If you don't know yourself well enough, if you're not practicing integration, your love of others is kind of confused by your own lack of self-knowledge. You start to believe you feel things that you don't really, that are just ideas. You mistake ideas for reality. You start to think, have ideas about yourself which aren't really to do with a really self-knowing, including spiritual ideas. So, for instance, it is quite possible to meditate within your own idea of yourself. It seems to be possible to even go quite deep in meditation, but be still just within your own idea of who you are. I'm a spiritual person, for instance, or a meditator. And you can have people who go very deep in that way, but who are very narrow, because they're basically living within an idea of themselves, even a spiritual idea of themselves, you see what I mean? We need to break out of an idea of ourselves, and I wanted, as I say, to talk about 3 ways in which we need to practice Kusala Karma. So they are generosity, community, and friendship. I think we could just, in my book, partly because I've talked about ethics so much, because really this is the stage of ethics, but I've talked about it so much I can barely write about them without nodding off. And if you're not careful, that's our whole attitude to ethics. It sort of loses its flavour. So we need to keep on reimagining what we're trying to do. And you could say simply, we're trying to be generous, we're trying to contribute towards the community, and we're trying to make friends. All the rest will follow if we do those things genuinely. So the first thing of Kusala Karma is we need to give. And give it by giving, you can't give to yourself, folks, so don't think that. it's not counted. It distorts the word to such a point that it becomes absurd. Someone said, well, my way of giving is I give myself a long bath. And I think, well, I'm afraid that doesn't count. You're welcome to have a bath if you want to, but that's not giving, no. So giving can mean giving your time, giving your money, giving gifts, giving your contribution, helping out, all of those things. I like to think of it as just helping out, just giving, just contributing, just lifting a hand to help, you know. My own feeling that this is, I mean, sometimes, I was talking about this, wasn't I, at the men's group, I was suddenly thinking, I've just talked about this before recently, wasn't I? Was I talking about it when we had our men's group? But sometimes, I think it's Virabodhi reminding me that the step path of Buddhism is often described as ethics, meditation and wisdom. But in some descriptions it's dana, ethics, meditation and wisdom. It's giving, generosity, ethics, meditation, wisdom. And I think that is truer. That spiritual life really starts, genuine spiritual life, starts with you giving. My own feeling is that unless you give, life doesn't live, if you see what I mean. Life doesn't get going. Nothing sort of happens. Partly I base this on some friends of mine who I think are very deep and do have a real understanding of the Dharma, and have got this one friend particularly who's got a very deep mind. But his great shortcoming actually is that he's not generous. And because he's not generous, it's like the whole machinery of spiritual life doesn't get moving. I mean this in a quasi-scientific sense, that the universe, as it were, is made up of all these little particles, and the way to get them moving is to give. Without giving, life doesn't move, it doesn't activate, nothing happens. Even if you're very intellectual, very emotionally sophisticated, very artistic, I know, very talented, very deep, unless you give, all of those things will wither on the bough. Even your talents, even your skills, unless you give, they'll just wither on the bough like dead fruit. It's more important to give than to be intellectual, which is, I think, wildly overrated. It's more important to give than to be witty and funny, which again is overrated. Etc., etc. You name it, it's more important to give. We'd be better off being a very simple person who just gives a lot. Even almost culpably at times, you know, you think, oh no, yeah, you shouldn't have given. I think it's that giving that makes spiritual life move. It activates the world. And we know it, don't we? As soon as we give, we feel bigger. You really feel a shift in the nature of things when you give. You've suddenly gone from a smaller mental state to a bigger mental state. Not only that, it seems to affect the air around you. You feel like life itself expands, like the universe expands when you give. The universe sounds such a grand place, doesn't it? But it actually must be here as well. So as soon as you give, the sort of universe seems to expand. It's as if the universe starts to move. And if you don't give, it doesn't expand and doesn't move. And now, of course, we can give in lots of different ways, but we should probably actually start from the most concrete way, like handing over, I was going to say a tenner, what would it be in Sweden?
100 kroner
to a friend who hasn't got much money. Just immediately put your hand in the pocket, grasp 100 kroner note and say, there you are, without thinking about it too much. We should just give like that. We should give gifts quite a lot. We should be always thinking, what little gifts can I get for people? People are a bit snooty sometimes about gifts and money, as if, oh yes, but really the real gift is blah, blah, blah. But hey, how about we really perfect gifts and money? If we did that a lot, the world would be a better place if we gave gifts and money a bit. And then, yes, of course, but then, of course, we can give time, we can give our enthusiasm, we can do things like help out, yeah? dead simple to do. You don't need to be in a good state of mind. You don't need to be anything, do you? You can be in a thoroughly bad state of mind, and you can say, how about I make us all a cup of tea? You know what I mean? You don't need to, you know, you don't need to go off and meditate before you do it. You can just go, tell you what, I'll make a cup of tea. Or tell you what, let me hold that for you because it looks a bit heavy. Or tell you what, I'll just open the door because you're struggling with a tray. You know what I mean? You don't need to be in any way to do it. That's why it's, you could think of spiritual life starting with generosity, because you don't need to be in a good state of mind to give. And as soon as you give, the universe expands. Yeah? So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is, to practice Kusala Karma, you need to contribute, participate in a like-minded community, which is what we are, just now, luckily. but you need to, I need to, participate in a community of fellow practitioners. I need to contribute to a group of fellow practitioners. I mean, my contribution at this, on this retreat, is mainly, you know, leading the meditations and doing this seminar. I'm not doing the washing up, I probably should be, but I'm not. I'm skiving off and running off and writing something. But the only way I can be part of this community is if I give to it. There's no community without participation. You can never experience community by looking at it. You only experience community the moment you participate. Sometimes it's very striking as well, isn't it? I don't know whether you've ever been on a class team, but I remember when I used to go to the Wednesday class at the London Buddhist Centre, and then I joined the team, and I think one of the early times I was holding the bowl for people to put the money in. And as soon as I held the bowl, I became part of a spiritual community. As soon as I participated, and I felt it immediately, I was no longer on the outside of this community, I was on the inside. I wasn't receiving, I was participating. Do you see what I mean? I think that is a central movement in our life, from passive receiving to active participation. And it's that active participation that is Kusala Karma, is skilled action. If we want to grow as human beings, we need to actively participate in a community, especially a community of like-minded people. Like-minded men and women. There is no spiritual life without this, folks. There's a strange new tendency to imagine spiritual life as a private matter. It's a horribly Western sort of contortion of Buddhism, really. I think the Buddha would find it really quite distasteful, not just wrong, but distasteful, that you can have my spiritual life. That I can think of it in terms of something I do on my own with my eyes closed. You cannot do that. When we think we are, we're just living out some kind of weird idea. It's nothing to do with Buddhism. What you see with Siddhartha's life, it's the first thing he did when he left home is he joined a community. He joined a community of practitioners, led by a teacher, just as we've done that. What he did, because a remarkable young man, he mastered everything that community could teach him, so much so that the people who led those spiritual communities offered him sole leadership, either joint leadership or sole leadership. But the thing to remember there is he mastered the teachings. So that would mean us, if we were to follow Siddhartha, it would mean us completely committing ourselves to the Triratna tradition and mastering the teachings that have come down to us from Bhante Sangharajita, and then, if we found that wanting, going on from there. I mean, you know, which would be quite remarkable. But that's what Siddhartha did. He didn't just go it alone. He actually joined a spiritual community, quite obviously. In fact, he joined one, mastered all the teachings, thought, actually, no, this isn't the solution to life. This isn't actually the great solution to the great problem. Found another spiritual community, learnt all that, And likewise, with this incredible integrity that he had, realized that that was not the great solution. But meanwhile, he mastered those teachings. And he contributed to those communities, so much so that the people leading it said, why don't you take over? You only offer that to somebody who's made a preeminent contribution, if you mean. I really want to stress this because I think it's understressed. There's no way in which we can integrate, for instance, without being part of a living, vital, spiritual community. Not really. Because we don't know ourselves, do we? Human beings, by definition, have got blind spots. Not always spots, they can be great vistas, blind vistas. whole blind area, you know, whole no-go areas. Things that we can't bear to face in ourselves. Things that we can't talk about. We cannot see that. We need other people to help us see it. Do you see what I mean? By definition, we need other people to challenge, merely by their reality, our self-conception. Do you see what I mean? Otherwise, we'll just live in our little self-conception, the me story that we've made. Largely, what self is, it's a story we tell ourselves. And we tell ourselves this story again and again. And really, we only see where it's wrong when that story knocks up against other people, particularly other people. And this becomes even more important when one is on a spiritual path, because before you know it, you start to think that you've got a special thing that you've experienced yourself, that you've got an attainment, you see. Now, you might have, but that might just be an idea. And if you're not careful, if I was to do like I have been for the last few weeks, I went and gave a talk in Manchester, then I gave a seminar in Croydon, now I'm here in Sweden, then soon I'm going to Spain to ordain someone. Now, if I was to do that all of my life, just hop from one place to another, doing this, having this rather grand chair to sit on, and this sort of very good-natured, patient audience to listen to, I could start to think I'm really quite special, couldn't I? Because look, I've got a big green chair, and I'm in front of you all, so I must be rather special. And then I start to have my special experiences, and I think, oh, look, everybody seems to be interested in me talking about them. But do you see what I mean? I could easily end up living in an idea of being a rather special, ordinary person. I could go off to one place or another and have that confirmed, couldn't I, by more and more people. The way to change that is if I came and lived with you. You know what I mean? That would be the way to change it, wouldn't it? Because if we were living together, if I was part of a vital community with you, where we got to know each other very, very deeply over time, there's no way I could maintain that idea. One of you would eventually say, I do want to talk about those cinnamon buns. I can't completely believe anymore that they aren't so... You know what I mean? Somebody would have to say something. Somebody that you'd get to know me in a much more rounded way, and I'd get to know you in a much more rounded way. So I couldn't live on the basis of my ideas about myself, and nor could you. Because you know what you know, really, you know. Do you see why you need that community for that to happen? It's only when people don't know you very well that you can fracture into this idea about yourself. Because there's no one to say, but that's just, you're always been a bit like that. It's just you being like that. What do you mean? You need someone with a pin to prick the balloon of self, yeah? Also, you need a community to discover who you are. So I was saying yesterday that, we come into life and we don't even know who we are. We have to discover it. And we don't discover that on our own. We discover it in relationship with other people. Because being myself means being myself with others. So one of the things for me in my life, and don't get me wrong, folks, I'm not that bothered about it, but, you know, I'm gay, is a simple way of putting it. I don't need to I don't know what that is in Swedish, but anyway, whatever in Swedish and that, my sexual preferences is for men. Actually, frankly, it's of no consequence. It's just like having curly hair. It's either been made far too much of or far too little of. It's just like, you've got curly hair, big deal, you know, let's make a career of it. It really is of no consequence. But it has been made into a massive problem. In fact, in many places still, it's something people will kill you for, just because you've got curly hair. It's like people hating you because you've got freckles. It's really as absurd as that. And the Christian tradition, particularly, as has Islam, all the theistic religions have been violently opposed to homosexuality, whether in men or women, to the degree to which it would actively harm people, imprison them, do unspeakable things because someone's got curly hair or freckles. Bhante recently said that he thought the church should apologise to gay men and lesbians for all the completely unnecessary suffering that the church has caused. Anyway, be that as it may, for me, coming into a community where I could be gay, as it were, but not defined by that, when I came out into the gay scene, I found it just as claustrophobic as the world I was already in. You had to be another kind of person, a gay person. And that seemed to... Anyway, I won't go on about it. But I wasn't very good at doing that kind of person either. You had to be much bigger than me and have a very tight white T-shirt. I tried the T-shirt, but it didn't work. I looked ridiculous. So what I wanted was a community in which I could just be myself. And part of being myself was that, but not an important part. But not a part that I was willing to pretend wasn't there. I couldn't see why I should pretend. There's nothing to pretend about, if you see what I mean. And so it is with us in all sorts of ways. To be able to be ourselves, we need a community that helps us be ourselves, that wants to know who we are, that isn't trying to create a church or a club or a in-crowd and an out-crowd, but is really trying to create a community that is encouraging each other to be ourselves, to discover ourselves, to express ourselves, as far as that's a skillful matter. There's nothing unskillful about being a gay man or a lesbian. There's no issue there. It's just socially frowned upon. We need a community in which to discover who we are. You know? So the second great stage of spiritual life involves active participation, contribution in a spiritual community. That's what Siddhartha did. He did it before he was enlightened, and guess what? After he was enlightened, he spent all of his time in the midst of a community. I was talking to somebody recently, and they were talking about the Buddha as if he was this sort of weirdo philosopher who just sort of walked off and did it all under a tree. You know what I mean? I just didn't recognise the Buddha from it. He said, well, he would have just sort of seen through the nature of reality. It was just a horrible sort of vision. But I had to remind him, but do you remember that after his enlightenment, he spent all of his life, every waking moment, almost of his life, in very, very close proximity to other people, with a whole group of people around him all the time. So much so that when, in one famous case, when an elderly monk had diarrhea, the Buddha and Ananda cleaned him up. The Buddha didn't say, oh, could a monk go and look after him? The Buddha himself did that. The enlightened one, the perfectly awake, he cleaned up this elderly monk's diarrhea, and then he called all the monks together and said, what's going on here? How come this has been let to happen? And the monk said, well, he's useless, he didn't do anything. But it's obviously not useless to the Buddha. So that's the kind of Buddha we're talking about. He was alone occasionally, but it's very, very rare. And when he mentions it in the sutras, it's obviously made something of. So there's one time where the monks come to see him, and they're so noisy, the Buddha just walks off into the jungle. It's just too noisy. And then there's another time when his companion goes to leave him, and he says, no, don't, you know, it's not good to the, for the Tathagata to be left alone. It's not because the Buddha was frightened of being alone in the jungle. It's just that, look, you're going to do much better by being with me. You know what I mean? So being alone for the Buddha was really quite unusual. Quite how we've made the Buddha into this, you know, go it alone, Clint Eastwood figure, I really don't know. anyway, there you go. If we're serious about the journey, we need to actively participate in community. And then thirdly, in terms of this kusala karma skilled action, we need to make friends. If I was to be asked what just two things you had to do in this stage, great stage of positive emotion, of which I've devoted two long chapters in my book, I would say be generous and make friends. That's it. The rest, if you genuinely do those two things, will follow. Be generous, make friends. If that doesn't sound deep enough, let's do it the other way. Make friends and be generous. That's it. That's all you need to say. So by make friends, I mean make friends. You know, become a friend, be a friend. And which is in distinction to be a mate. I don't know what the female equivalent is. It's a rather male phenomenon very often, but where you have mates. So mates are people who you josh with, laugh with, tease, have a drink with, but you don't tell them all kinds of things about yourself. There are all kinds of off-limits areas that you won't talk about. And you gloss over that by pretending that you're friends. Being a mate of somebody, or the female equivalent of that, inoculates you against friendship. It makes you think that you've got friends when you haven't. And it would be better to acknowledge that than to pretend, if you see what I mean. So friendship in Buddhism is seen as a very profound matter. It can only take place between two free individuals. I always want to emphasize it primarily takes place between people of the same gender, irrespective of whether they're gay or straight. It can take place between men and women, but it's rarer, usually, because of the tendency for men and women to project onto each other. Usually, friendships between men and women, genuine ones, are with people, between people, men and women, who've already got very established existing friendships of their own gender. That's been my experience for those around me. Particularly the men I see around me, I see some men who mainly make friends with women, and it's clearly for them because it's easier. They don't get a certain kind of challenge. Difficult to express why, but... And men very easily want to rescue women, and most women don't need to be rescued. In fact, they're probably actually rather fed up with it. Or, you know, men are looking for a mother figure or whatever, and women are looking for a father. So we need to make friends, first of all, I think, with members of our own gender. And making friends means being really transparent to the other person. The first thing it means is spending time with them. In a way, that's pretty much all it means. You need to spend time with them. You need to actually spend quite a lot of time with friends. I'm starting to slightly regret how much I've been travelling, because I've been thinking, hang on, I've been in Croydon, then I was in Manchester, now I'm in Sweden, now I'm going to be in Spain. And I think, oh no, it's all right, because I'm going to Spain with a very, very old friend of mine. We're going to have a little holiday together, just as two friends. We're going to go and look at some paintings, Jan of Archer and I, drink coffee, eat ice cream, and talk a lot. That's what we do. Look at paintings a lot, look at buildings. And then I'm going to go on another retreat, and I'm ordaining a friend of mine. So, that's all right. In those times, at least, I'm deepening my friendships. But we need to be arranging our life in such a way that we can cross over with our friends a lot. I mean, really a lot. The best option, of course, is to live with them, because that's where you cross over most. Much of my best friends have been people I've lived with. You know, Archer lives literally the opposite side of the corridor to me, so we're constantly just going into each other's rooms. I was recently sharing, most recently sharing a room with an Australian guy, Canute, and who actually did sleep with an Australian flag above his bed and a didgeridoo on the side of his bed, which I thought was going a bit far, but I expected a kangaroo to come in any moment. But, you know, it was by sharing with him that I became friends. Because when you share a space with each other, you can't be on good behaviour. You just can't. Not when they see you in your pyjamas, you know what I mean? You can't do it. You can't have a show, you know what I mean? So friendship is like that. There can't be any show. There can't be any status. Whether your university education, your clever jokes, your charm, all of that is as naught in friendship in a way. It's a meeting, a direct meeting between people who want the best from each other and want the best from themselves. And it's difficult to talk about, because I've written a whole book about it for heaven's sake, but so it can't be that difficult to talk about. But mainly just think about giving friends time, and time in the sense of seeing them often, and think of it as being a long-term investment. Friendship develops very, very, very gradually. You can't force the pace. I've come to think that friendship is the spiritual life looked at in close relationship to other people. So you've got the journey, and you imagine that as you on a journey. If you were to imagine the journey with others, you'd see friendship. And just like the journey, friendship takes a long time. Just like the journey, it goes through peaks and troughs. You get a bit lost. You have bad times and good times. So it is with friendship. Yeah. The best qualities to look for in a friend are someone who shares your vision of reality, who shares your deep feeling that life is a great problem to be solved. Not something to whistle as we walk past the graveyard, not something to waste, but a great problem to be solved. That the Buddha is the exemplar of that solution, and that you share that very deeply in common. Even if you disagree on lots of things, if you're very temperamentally different, that's not so important. Even actually at first, whether you like them isn't that important. It's handy, but it's not that important. It's wildly overrated. I've made friends with people that I immediately didn't like, and I've not managed to make friends with people who I did like. I used to think that friendliness in people would lead to friendship, but it actually often doesn't. Friendliness, some people are just friendly, but they don't mean anything by it. Some people actually aren't very friendly, but actually can be very, very good friends. So look for someone who shares your vision and is loyal to friendship, who will actually put themselves out a bit for friendship, and who will renounce pride rather than the friendship, who will allow you to say things. Because as soon as there's a no-go area, as soon as there's something you can't say in a friendship, that's the limit of the friendship. It really is the case. If there's something you can't admit about yourself, in the right context, in real communication, not offloading onto people, which is just aggression in another way, but in that real spirit of friendship, if there are places you can't speak, that's the edge of the friendship. You know what I mean? Friends, to be a friend, you have to be completely naked, really. There's a wonderful bit in Julius Caesar, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, where he says, oh yes, I could see that the friendship was cooling because he became polite. As soon as your friend starts to become polite, that means there's a problem. You know, as soon as they have to say, would you mind, da, 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 you think, what's up? You know what I mean? Politeness is a sort of distance, isn't it? And yes, you need to be polite with people, but with friends, you don't need to be polite in that way. You know they know, and you know they know, sort of thing. There's lots more to say about that, but that'll do for now. So those are the three things I would really emphasise about Kusala Karma, skilled action, is that we give, we contribute, we lend a hand, we help out, we actively participate in a community of like-minded men and women, and that we make friends. If we could do those three things, the rest of Kusala Karma would arise, because there's no friendship, for instance, in vice. You can't be friends with people who lie, for instance, because you don't know who you're being friends with. So everything arises from those three things. And that's our second great sort of goal, is to live in positive emotion, to exemplify positive emotion. Because then, with our integration, when we fully know the kind of creature we are, where we're when we're collected, when we're whole, we can start to genuinely act for the welfare of the world. Because our action isn't an idea, isn't something that we can't live through. Very often, we mean our actions well enough, we mean our intentions, but we've not got the integration to see them through. This is often the case, isn't it? We on a retreat like this, and you can feel really inspired by it, and you really want to go on this great journey of human life, but we don't have the integration to see it through. A few days, a few weeks later, and another self is taken over. That's one of the great issues, really, about integration, is can we stick at it? It's our lack of integration that means that we don't. Once we have, as it were, thinking of it as a path rather than a mandala, but once we have that integration, then we can truly act for the benefit of others. As we act for the benefit of others, self becomes more and more light, more and more transparent. You can tell this, can't you? When you're in a genuinely positive mental state, you don't think about yourself very much. Self is kind of transparent when you're in a genuinely positive mental state. Psychologists call it flow. You just sort of flow into your experience without thinking about it very much, without thinking, oh, am I happy? As soon as you think, am I happy, you're not very happy anymore. It's mean. You see it again with children, don't you, where you see them playing. And they're quite obviously happy. But if you say, are you enjoying what you're doing? They look at you as if they say, what's he talking about? It's a very odd, kind of abstract question. And they sort of think, yeah, why? Because they have to then stop what they're doing, sort of stand out of it and think, is this enjoyable? But they were just enjoying it. Just mean, you've actually stopped them enjoying it. You can see children like that. And we're like that at our best. When our meditation's going deeply, we've forgotten whether we want to get anywhere in meditation. We're just in the meditation. When we're listening to a piece of music deeply, we've forgotten that we want to be an arty person or we like Beethoven. We're just like really in the music. The great sign of positive emotion is when self seems to evaporate or at least becomes transparent. Very often time will seem to stand still as well, won't it? Or time bends. So you feel that sometimes on retreat, don't you, that a day can feel both very long and very short. You get this experience of time begin to bend because probably time is very strongly to do with craving, to do with wanting. So if some beautiful person says they'd like you to see tomorrow for a hot date, time, you'll suddenly feel time very, very strongly. Or if tomorrow you have a really difficult exam that you're really dreading, you'll feel time very strongly. But when you're just absorbed in a book or just absorbed in the beautiful Swedish countryside, time sort of disappears. Yeah? So that's how you know you're in skilled action, how you know whether there's positive emotion, whether self is not there, I mean, or seems transparent. But of course, that's not the end, because you can live in a more and more refined state of mind. And if you're not careful, it starts to ossify. You do see this in some people, that they get very cultured, very intelligent. They live a very civilized life. But you start to feel that their life has started to ossify, has started to become a constriction, like sugar drying, sort of becomes tighter. They live a beautiful life, they have a beautiful place, they only listen to gorgeous music, they have friends, but it's all starting to get tight, it becomes like a cage of sugar. So eventually we need to see beyond self altogether. You can never refine yourself beyond self, because within in this stage of Kusala Karma, it's the stage of action, the stage of willed action, the stage of skilled action. But we're trying to act in such a way as to disappear. And we can't do that. Even if we're very, very refined, there's just still self. Eventually, we have to die. There has to be spiritual death. And it'll be that I'll come on to, finally, tomorrow, because I've talked long enough. Tomorrow I want to then explore how we have to die. And then, on the basis of that death, a rebirth will appear. There'll be spiritual rebirth. That's just what will happen. But I'll talk about those tomorrow. Just before we finish, is there any questions about what I've talked about today? So I followed the whole path from Siddhartha leaving the palace, going forth, the devas appearing, and that showing that this is a vital moment because the Buddha acted. He did something about his perception. We only know our perceptions are real when they make us act. You know that you are genuinely interested in Buddhism because you've come here. Lots of people say they're interested in Buddhism and never go on retreat, never meditate. So they're not really that interested, yeah? The fact that you're here tells you that this matters to you. It tells you that more than any feeling you have about it. Because, tell you what, you've been willing to not do all these things at home, you've been willing to leave people at home, and you've been willing to come on retreat. Your actions show that this is an important matter to you. Some of you have even travelled some distance. And then I've tried to say that three main things I think we could simply do is to give, to take part in a community of like-minded people, and to make friends. But we've got a bit of time for questions before we have our glorious period of free time. Much looked forward.
Stuck on something you said, just based on
empirical
experience.
Yeah.
If you're doing something skillfully, you have this sort of transparency yourself. But
yeah.
I mean, a really thorough session with YouTube will have approximately the same effect.
Yes. Yes. It's interesting. We need to get any of these points, and ends up wanting to be much larger in itself. But for instance, when we talk about concentration now, we need to be really clear that it's not the kind of concentration you have on a computer. So when you work on a computer, you can get very concentrated, can't you? So much so that you don't notice that you're physically stiff, you don't notice that you're dying to go to the loo, and you've got dehydrated, and you end up wanting to do one more click. That's nothing remotely like the concentration the Buddha is trying to teach.
Yeah,
you see what I mean? But people do that very often, have that kind of concentration. You know what kind of concentration it is because as soon as you come away from the computer, you feel thin. You feel like your psyche has become just like a piece of tin foil. In fact, if you were to do a sort of psychic X-ray, you'd just be this huge pair of eyes and these fingertips. That's all there'd be left. Yeah. Similarly, with your example of YouTube, you can be drawn into that in that kind of obsessive way. You know, the way you know whether it's a real thing is how it leaves you feeling. What happens when you turn the computer off? How are you left feeling? When you have a communication with a friend, how are you left? When you've just gone for a walk in the countryside, when you've just done a meditation, what are you left with? That's the value of something. It's interesting, too, of the arts. So sometimes people worry about, yes, but do arts have to be positive? Well, again, it depends how it leaves you feeling. Does it leave you feeling connected, deepened, rich, enriched, and so on? Or does it leave you feeling alienated, dispersed, upset in the chemical sense? What does it do? So, I saw King Lear. I find it unbearable almost to watch. I've watched it so many times. I think, oh my God, I'm doing it again. I'm watching that awful thing. It's so violent and so horrible. At the end, you have this very distinctive feeling of having learned something absolutely essential about the nature of life. but you can't say what it is. But you feel deepened. And one of the things you notice is you feel very reluctant to go back into your propunctura. So I want to be very careful nowadays about who I go to a concert with, or who I go to a film with, or who I go to a play with. If you go with the right person, you finish the play and you're that lovely, or the film finishes and you have that lovely, I'm just going to sit here. I went to see called the Lake Quartet, about, I don't know what it's called in Swedish, it's about a quartet playing Beethoven's Opus 131. It's probably come out. I found it very, very moving. It's nearly great, it's not quite. Or let's think of a Swedish example. Let's go and see Fanny and Alexander, which I think is quite clearly a great film. You go and see it, and what you want is someone to leave you alone for a bit at the end, don't you? You want to absorb something. You can't even say what, but you feel, don't you, after seeing that film, that you have a greater sense of life, that you've grown up a bit, that you've been sobered up. You've seen what vicious authority can be like. You've somehow understood childhood more deeply. You've seen that there is magic in life. You've seen that family can matter. You know, you've seen all kinds of, but you can't really reduce it to those things. You're just left with this glow of feeling, and you want to stay in it, don't you? You just want to be in it. And it's really irritating when the person you've gone with immediately wants to chatter. So they want to say, they want to talk about their daughter's homework or the new car they bought. Or it's really frustrating, isn't it? You can feel yourself being pulled away from a deepened, enriched experience into talk again. And how tiresome and point-missing talk is. But then if you go with the right person, you'll get that, let's just sit here while everybody's walking out. And that's what I tend to do in cinemas, clattering out. You just want to sort of stay there. I remember once going to see Medea, a Greek tragedy. It was so unbearable. At the end, I couldn't believe that people were clapping. The vision it was teaching was so terrifying about the possibilities of human cruelty. I just thought it should have been a ritual. We should have just all sat there in silence and absorbed it. You know, nobody should have been allowed to speak or move. I mean, after all, that's what theatre was. It was a ritual. It wasn't meant to be an entertainment. It was meant to be a ritual that changed you. But if you go with the right person, they'll give you that pause because they themselves feel that. And then they will start to talk in a way that draws out what you've seen. Oh, I really like that scene. Da-da-da-da. Did you notice that? And that referred to that, didn't it? And wasn't it interesting that they brought that in? To see how that really... Gosh, I really noticed that, this bit. And sometimes when that happens, as you're walking home together, you sort of watch it again, don't you, in your mind. And you re-enrich it. And again, you see what a friend can do and what a mate can do. What somebody like-minded can do and what somebody not like-minded can do. Yeah. So I think it's that shows you. Do you have this sense of enrichment, and have you fallen away from propunctura? Our best moments, propunctura disappears, doesn't it? When you really see the beauty of the landscape. Sometimes you just walk out of meditation and for a moment the sheer beauty of things strikes you. And for that moment there's no propunctura. Just for that moment, it's a moment of liberation. There's no what you think about it, there's no what I'm going to do about it. There's just pure experience without propunctura. And it has this direct quality, this enriched quality. Yeah. Very long answer. It's almost a talk in itself. Any last question before we...
I was wondering about friendship.
Yeah.
Because the way you talked about friendship was more like with equal friends or central friends.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
When you have a relationship.
Yeah.
To more experienced friends.
Yeah, so I didn't talk about Kalyana Mitra. In fact, I haven't talked about it in my book yet. I must think of where... Thank you for reminding me, because I'm thinking about where I can put that. I'll think about that later. I'll go and write it on my computer after this. That's a problem. So in Buddhism you have friendship. Kalyana Mitra is a word. Kalyana means auspicious. It means lucky. It means fortunate. Mitra means friendship. So this isn't just friendship, it's auspicious friendship. It's that time where you think, gosh, I'm really lucky to have this friend. This is somebody I can really be honest with. What a relief. I can be understood. It's really lovely, isn't it, to be understood by someone. Because for me, particularly, I find it difficult sometimes to be quite clear what I mean, but I have hunches about things, and I need friends that I can say what my hunch is, and they know what I'm trying to do. They don't immediately kind of close me down, if you see what I mean. But yes, so when I have that experience, I feel very fortunate. But then, in Buddhism, has come to me, particularly keep friends with people who've got more experience than you of the path. And that is, I think, vital. I think human beings need someone to look up to. And it's not good enough just to have the Buddha. It's not good enough just to have someone who's safely dead, if you know what I mean. It's good, but it's not good enough. Because they can never... You don't have to negotiate the problems of humanity because they're safely dead. And they can be sort of covered in gold leaf and nobody worries. You need someone on the path who has more experience of the path than you and who can help you. And you need to be able to find a way of being friends with them. I've been very, very fortunate in that way that I've always had around me people I can look up to. And I've been very receptive to that. I think one of my qualities, if I can say that, is I am very receptive generally, despite my outspokenness. I will learn things from people. So we need friends that we can look up to, that we're receptive to. Without being receptive, there's no point really. You won't learn anything, so it's not worth it. The great, exemplar of this in Western culture is the Italian painter Raphael. Does anyone know him? Anyway, paints beautiful pictures of the Virgin and Child, mostly, because that's what most of the people wanted. They're renowned for their charm and beauty and delicacy and structure and so on. And when you look at his early paintings, he's actually not very good. They're all right, but they're not very good. Certainly not outstanding. What you see with him mainly is someone who could learn and learn voraciously. I can't remember who his first teacher was now. Never can remember his name. Not a very good painter either. But actually, when you look at his paintings under his influence, you can almost not tell the difference between Raphael and this person, Perugino, I think. They are. They're pretty much the same. Not great, but they're better than the ones before. But then, of course, he goes to Florence. He happens to be in Florence at exactly the same time as Michelangelo and Leonardo, and just basically learns everything from them. So much so that Michelangelo hated him because he thought he'd nicked all his ideas, which he had. But what's amazing about him as a person is obviously not threatened by that. He didn't think, no, but I've got to do it my way. No, it's all very well, you do it like that. And Leonardo, you do it this kind of sort of blurry way. But Michelangelo, you're really good at doing it in this way. I'm going to do my own way. He didn't seem to have any of that. There's a painting of Moses that you think is Michelangelo, but it's Raphael. There's another painting you think is Leonardo, but it's him. But it's Raphael. He just obviously didn't feel at all threatened by it. So he just completely learned everything they could teach him, or stole from them. And then his mature work is very definitely him, that he brings in a sort of feeling for colour that neither of them have. But he doesn't seem to insist on it. He just learns, you know. I think that's a wonderful example. Not a particularly talented painter at first. His great talent is being receptive. He just learned. In a way, you don't need to be anybody. You can just be yourself. All you need to do is be willing to learn and not be threatened by other people's greatness, if you mean. Just be willing to learn from it. That's what I've done, largely. So that's my answer to that. I'll put that in the book somewhere. Thank you for reminding me. It's a rather important thing to forget. Okay, so let's look at that. We've sat in this slightly darkened room long enough. We can pour outside and drink tea. Thank you very much.